Physics is based on the repeatedness. That means there is a model, and it was in 19th century, early 20th century, there was the model of ether. And till today, even some presenters in TV use that word. That model was wrong. Then there was Albert Einstein with E equal MC squared and a new understanding of physics. So if we can repeat something independently and confirm its presence, then we change the model that wasn't provable, was totally wrong. And we can also say about a model of the atom that was changing during time, during the years. So you could say a few words about what physics is and what physics is based on. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
AC2 GX. Well, I mean, basically it's science in general. The scientific method, which came into existence around the 15th century, is one and is different than the old natural philosophers of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. You know, these guys sat on rocks and thought up things. I think Plato thought that women had less teeth than men because he couldn't be bothered to actually just have them open their mouth and count. So the modern scientific method depends upon the ability to repeat things that are discovered. You know, if you discover something, then the guy down the block should be able to repeat it using your methods. It's the con artists who tell you that, well, it has to be in a particular location, and it depends upon your mood. If you're pessimistic about the experiment won't work. That's a sign of nonsense. It has nothing to do with science. So the idea is not to be biased in favor of something you came up with, to set up actual experiments to either prove or disprove, to only set up theories that can be proved in one way or the other. Non-falsifiable theories are worthless, because if you can't falsify them, you know, what are they worth? So set up a thesis that can be falsified and then run experiments to try to falsify them and have other people run the experiments and such. And so we slowly build on the shoulders of others, and we learn more and more. And the people who want to kind of turn science into just another religion and then be able to just kind of shake it off are completely misunderstanding everything. We don't take beliefs. We take ideas, and then we prove them over and over again. Back in the good old days when John was around, we started to talk about entangled particles. And John kind of thought that it was all theoretical boobity-bop, that just, you know, overpaid physics professors were sort of making stuff up. But, you know, it's possible to demonstrate quantum entanglement in a college, a classroom, and has been done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's the ability to repeat those things in person. I've done labs. You've done labs. A lot of people who've passed through the sciences have done labs that are based on the underlying principles, and they hold up. That's what science is, the fact that they're consistent and that they hold up, not that some guy who said something. You know, I mean, we talk about evolution. Evolution has gone farther than Darwin would ever think. So people who want to dismiss evolution as 18th century Darwinism are just setting up straw dogs, straw men. It's not what the modern day evolution, which is mostly genetics, which Darwin had no clue about genetics because it was the 1800s.
Yeah, but he became known in the history as the first one who had the courage to talk about it back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always got to be the first guy, but that doesn't mean that he's a sage. You know, a lot of religious people, unfortunately, like to take him on as science or biology's Moses. He's not. He was a very smart guy. He wasn't afraid of upsetting some apple carts, but it's not his theory that we work on today. It's the beginnings. His theory was the beginnings of evolution as we know it today. But if you sat him down and gave him a couple of courses in evolution, he wouldn't quite know what you were talking about, because it goes much, much farther than survival of the fittest. But, you know, I mean, everyone appreciates what he did, but he's not a god, he's not a prophet, and he's just, like Newton. Newton set us straight on a lot of things, but Newton wasn't right about everything. Fortunately, Einstein came along and discussed the fact that all these things are relative to each other. Back in Newtonian physics, there is a fundamental frame of reference. In Einsteinian relativity, there is no particular frame of reference that's more legitimate than any other frame of reference.
Yeah, when you start to talking about Newton, I recall Copernicus, Polish priest. He was a priest. So Nicholas Copernicus was a priest, and in May 24 of 1543, was a Renaissance of polymath who formulated a model of the universe that plays the sun rather than the earth at its center. So we're talking about the deep, dark time when people could lose their life in the flames, and torture was widely used. And we have a guy who decided that he wants to be loud about it. Actually,
humanity is capable of great things and terrible things, and one of the terrible things is religious ignorance. You screwed around with this guy's worldview, and if he has the power to get rid of you, he will. And keep in mind, those people are still out there. You see them on the news every day. There's a lot of religious ignorant people who think that the world is about 6,000 years old, and we used to live with dinosaurs as pets, and all kinds of silly stuff. And it's in our nature. There's greatness, and there's awfulness. And unfortunately, we're seeing a little bit more awful than we should these days.
Thank you very much. I think it's a time for Paul and Space Report. And to each
year. Okay, thank you very much again, Wesley. And yes, indeed, it's 10:21 and change, so it's certainly a good time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Oh, okay, thanks, Roy. And the National Science Foundation, which has done great wonders over the years. They cut them, I was reading the other day, 55% of their budget gone out the window. So I don't know what they're going to study anymore. That's the same group that funded the Arecibo project, and all great stuff. Citizen science is all through the National Science Foundation, did that whole thing with the solar eclipse last year and all. My guess is this will change eventually, and once they get a new group in there, I think they'll just reverse everything. Anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, I have a few topics I could go through here. Let me drop it.
Paul?
Yeah, besides cutting the NSF, you know, they also want to cut our Mars Odyssey program, which has been in orbit around Mars since 2001. That's where they came up with the name, the Mars Odyssey. Took it from the movie, from the Space Odyssey. MAVEN, another Mars orbiting spacecraft. It's been a highly elliptical in a Mars orbit for many, many years now. They want to cut that. They want to cut, you know, the all the information coming back and forth, which is ridiculous. I mean, it takes a fortune to put these things into orbit, and then, you know, all you have to do is have operators, scientists, you know, reading the information that's coming back. You know, you don't need the expense of launching more rockets. Just shut it off. The Mars sample returns. They want to cancel that. As far as I know, that's like the top of the list, because it is a $10 billion project, you know, over 10 years, so that's gonna go out the window, along with you know future of Mars and even Venus missions and even Chandra X-ray telescope. That thing is one of the great telescopes that was launched with in the Hubble era, and that's still functioning. That goes what, 3/4 of the way to the moon, and then it comes back very close to Earth on a regular basis. So it goes out to, I think, 80,000 or so miles, and then comes back within about 1,000 or so miles of Earth. Great, great telescope. You know, all X-ray vision. Let me drop it. And of course, thereafter, the SLS, the space system, and the Artemis program in general. They want to leave it up to Artemis 3 and then just drop it, and which doesn't make any sense at all, because, you know, it took decades to develop this whole thing, and then just have 3 missions and call it quits. That definitely doesn't make any sense. And the system worked. You know, we've already sent a crew vehicle without a crew to the moon and back on a 25-day trip. Gateway, future space station that will be in orbit around the moon. They want to cancel that. And then, you know, that would be great. You know, you'd have a crew on there, you know, on a regular basis, you know, for maybe a month or two at a time, and then bring them back. Maybe, you know, then it would work autonomously for months or even years until you sent another crew out there. So, you know, that's hardware built, but it's a gateway mission or space station. And what are they going to do, put it in mothballs again? Like they did with Triana, I've talked about that many times. That was the weather satellite in the old days. Al Gore pushing that when he was vice president. That was the one that was going to stare at Earth 24 hours a day. You'd be able to get online and look to see what Earth looks like at any time, 24 hours a day. Because it was going to be at the Lagrange point 1, a million miles away from Earth, travel around the sun, you know, with Earth, not orbiting Earth, but just, you know, orbiting the sun. And they canceled that, put it into mothballs for many, many years until I think the probably around 2008 or so, a little bit later. They took it out of storage, put new experiments on board, and launched it. They just changed their name. Instead of Triana, they put Discover. Anyway, before I move on, anybody want to comment? This is Paul, WS2N. Okay,
it's
all the news and everything.
You, how are you this
week? What's going on? I turned the TV on expecting to see something about the Japanese spacecraft that was supposed to land on the moon. And I really didn't see any. You have to search for it on the internet. But this thing was launched back in January. It's called a Resilience. And the idea was to land on the moon. It was launched with another moon lander from a completely different company and different country. Resilience was built by built in Japan, and it's their second attempt to do that, to land on the moon. Their first one didn't go well. I mean, they got close, but then the software misinterpreted the height. Where they were, they went over a crater and the hill, and it thought that it was on the surface. So the engine shut off, and sure enough, the gravity of the moon pulled the first lander into the surface of the moon, and that was the end of that one. But here they tried again. That was back in 23. They tried again, launched in January with Blue Ghost. Blue Ghost was another moon lander built by Firefly Company, and United States Company. So they were both put into the fairing of a SpaceX vehicle and successfully launched to the moon. Only took Blue Ghost 40 days to get to the moon. More of a direct path. It orbited the Earth a couple of times. Every time it orbited, it would ignite the engine, and until they eventually got away from Earth gravity, until they got caught up into the moon gravity, and sure enough, that thing landed. That was very successful. After launch, it landed. And they planned on operating for 14 days, and it did just that. It landed and lasted 14 days. So that was a 100% mission. This other one that went up, built by Japan, called Resilience, it was supposed to go all the way out to the, almost to the Lagrange Point 1. Which is what, about four times the distance away from the moon, and then come back, let them pull the moon's gravity, pull it back in, especially fired its engines and wanted to orbit around the moon. The reason they do that is they could save on the amount of energy. If they go out to Lagrange Point 1, slowly come back like that, they could save up to 10% energy, which means you could have a bigger payload, or you don't need as powerful of a rocket to deorbit and all. So there's advantages to do that, and that's why they did it. So here it comes back, gets into orbit, and then a couple days ago, last Thursday, it was supposed to land, and it got to the point where it did a tilt over. It comes in horizontally and then it's supposed to do a tilt over and come down vertically. Which it started to do. And, instead of having radar to determine how high they are above the surface, it's modern times, so they use a laser system. Which is better because the laser system has a lighter weight, and again, it's a payload versus a thrust capability. So they choose lasers nowadays to do that. apparently that was unable to detect the surface of the moon, and they're still looking into the exact reason, but they do know that they lost contact about a minute before landing, so the predictions are that it crashed into the moon, and of course they try to contact it, see if anything survived, but you know, they estimate that it probably hit around 60 miles per hour. Well, you hit a wall with a car at 60 miles an hour, and you can imagine what, you know, the kind of damage you're going to do, especially a spacecraft like this. But try again. 2027, Japan will send another lander. And this thing was big. It was almost 8 foot tall, and I don't know, about 7 foot wide. They'll try again. It had a little rover on board. If it had landed, the little rover was going to drive off the vehicle and take pictures of, you know, the rover itself, wherever it was sitting. And that little model house on it, called Moon House. And they were going to place it on the on a regolith somewhere, you know, the regolith, the moon dirt. You know, they were going to put it there and take pictures of this little red house. It was only about, you know, maybe 5 inches high by 4 inches wide or something. But, you know, you never know. They had plenty of science experiments on board, but this was some artist that wanted to do this. Any comments, put in that WS2F.
This is KE2AJU, Paul.
Good evening, Charlie. How are you? Good to hear from you. Any comments or anything? Back to you.
Yes, on Resilient, the Japanese space craft that went to the moon, this is a private company doing that from Japan?
Yes, it is, and it's their second try. Japan has done it with another spacecraft, but that was, you know, through the country itself, and that was successful. That was called SLIM, S-L-I-M. They did it a while back. But there's quite a few private companies doing this. I mean, the other one that I talked about before, Blue Ghost, that landed and lasted for 14 days, that's an American company, Firefly, private company that did that. Back to you, Charlie.
So they're not going to try again until 27? That's a long way away.
Yeah, I guess I have to figure out exactly what went wrong. Probably they think with the laser system and beef it up a little bit. I understand the next one, they're going to have a little bit more powerful engine, or a completely different engine. So, you know, they're going to make some changes on number three. So, we'll see. I think sooner or later they'll make it, you know. And we'll see how they do. Now, Blue Ghost, when that, I said, that went up with them, that landed successfully, you know, that's built by Firefly. They have another planned mission. They're hoping that maybe they can get the other Blue Ghost to launch by the end of this year. But I don't know, if there's delays, you know, maybe early next year. But they're going to try again, and I think this is the one. I think that Blue Ghost, they're going to try landing on the opposite side of the moon, on the far side. Well, a lot of things, you know, coming up. They're private companies, so, you know, the government won't be able to cut their funding. So, I think those missions will continue on. Back to you, John.
I hope they don't cut their funding because Japan has come so close.
Well, I'm talking about our company, the Firefly company, the American company. They can't cut their funding because it's private, not a government project. And with resilience, their spacecraft, that's being funded privately. And Japan is adding money to their space program and science programs, so there's no problem there, Charles.
I hope they don't cut the U.S. program. They got a new crew going into the space shuttle, International Space Station tomorrow.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. That's called Axiom 4 mission. Axiom is a private company. And they're going to be launched at a space station on a Crew Dragon spacecraft, by SpaceX. So in other words, Axiom, this private company, I guess they're paying SpaceX to do this. This is their fourth mission. They've had three previous missions. And this one, they were also going to go to the International Station. Commander is Peggy Whitson. She's had, probably half a dozen flights to the space station. When she was working for NASA, she's retired from NASA. In fact, she was in charge of the astronaut corps for a while. But she's now, retired from NASA, but working for this private company, Axiom. So this will be her second flight, I think, with Axiom. Look it up, maybe the third, where she's commander. Even though it's a private company, NASA's rules are if you're going to be a private company and you're going to dock with the International Space Station, you have to have somebody that's either working for NASA or someone that's retired from NASA to have a commander do that. And then she's got three other passengers going with her. So they'll spend like a week or so, usually a week to 10 days, I think, on board the station. And then they'll come back. It's that kind of a mission. It's not like a regular NASA mission where they go up for 5-6 months at a time. This is a visiting crew. They'll spend some time up there. They actually pay NASA. Axiom paid NASA to, for their facilities, there's some kind of a deal that's worked out with that. And the reason Axiom is doing this, is because they plan on building modules, their own space station. But having them launch into orbit and then bolting them together, what they plan on doing is launching the modules and then docking it to the International Space Station, to the front of the space station, to the Harmony module. That'll be the first one, and then eventually two or three more over time will be docked to the space station. Now, this all has to happen before. Well, the predicted date we talked about earlier would be 2031, when NASA would like to deorbit the space station. Anyway, what Axiom is planning on doing is having their complete space station attached to the International Space Station before the ISS burns up. At some point, they plan on disconnecting what they've attached, maybe three or four modules, and then floating away and they'll become their own independent space station. ISS burns up, and here Axiom will be a private floating space station. I think that's really something, and that's what they're working on. Again, they have, I think the first module is pretty well built. I think it's going through testing or something now. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, they got a Polish woman, a woman from Hungary, India.
Yeah, there you go. That's their crew. Last time they had a couple of people, I think from the United Arab Emirates, one of the last flights. But yeah, and then Axiom, once they have their private space station, you know, they can do this on a regular basis. They'll be able to charge people to stay on their space station. Now, they don't have any way to get there. They need, like SpaceX or, you know, some launch provider to do that. They're not big enough yet to have their own rockets. So, we'll see. And the interesting thing about this launch, I think it's Tuesday morning, I believe it is. They plan on also having another launch a half hour later, you know, from Florida. So this thing will launch from Launch Complex 39A. And then they have another one that will launch from Launch Complex 40. And that's going to be another, I believe that's a Starlink mission, more satellites for SpaceX. But it'll be very close. They're claiming that, nobody's ever done this before, you know. But they have to go back in time. I remember well when you had Gemini 8 launch, and then right before Gemini 8 launch, you had the Agena spacecraft launch. And Agena was the target vehicle for that launch, and then about an hour later, the Gemini spacecraft launched. And the idea was for the two to catch up with one another, and after they did, they actually docked. They were practicing docking. This goes back to 1960, probably 65. You know. Anyway, let me just move on here. A couple of other things I just wanted to cover. WS2F. Okay, there's a telescope that's being built, not in space, but in Chile. So Chile has these the Atacama Desert. So it's a desert that's, I don't know, 8,000-9,000 miles high. It, like, never, ever rains there, ever, you know. And so it's, like, very dry. I mean, no clouds. And that part of Chile has half a dozen or more observatories, different gigantic telescopes that are put there. Well, the latest one to open, and it's going to be open real soon, is one called the Vera Rubin Space Telescope. Regular telescope. Vera Rubin is this massive thing. It's working off of, I think they came up with the idea like 15, 20 years ago, but it's finally coming to completion, and it's got a diameter mirror of like 27 feet, and then that goes to a secondary mirror, and then to a tertiary mirror, which is like a third mirror, and usually, you know, when you read about these mirrors, it starts off like big, like a 30-foot diameter, and then it goes down to a 10-foot, and then it goes down to a small, you know, maybe 6-inch thing, and on that they have these charge coupled devices, and that's what records the pictures. You know, essentially, you know, a camera. Let me drop it. Vera Rubin telescope in Chile has this charge couple device, and the thing it's 64 centimeters, so it's a little less than, you know, maybe a third less than a meter, but it's this big thing, and that's going to be receiving the signals, and the amount of gigapixels that are on this thing is 3.2 gigapixels. So it's the biggest CCD, or, you know, charge couple device, and we all have them on our cameras, but this is the biggest one ever made. I got such a kick out of it. I sent it over to Roy to see if he would put it onto his website. You can actually see what this thing looks like if you go to roy.at2gs.com, and you go there and scroll down a little bit to my section. He's got a section for any time I want to put a picture up. You scroll down a little bit, and here's this woman holding this massive charge couple device. And just for an idea of what they're looking at, they have a picture of the moon of superimposed on this couple device, showing that, you know, that when this thing will be scanning, you know, the moon will be like no problem to scan that, and they'll be scanning everything else around it. So they expect to get like tremendous amount of pictures of things that they've never seen ever before, you know, throughout the solar system and universe, by using this telescope, and they named it after Vera Rubin, which is a good idea. She's the astronomer years ago that sat around looking at plates, looking at, in the old days when they actually had photograph plates, and over time figured out that, you know, things were going on with these galaxies, and through investigation, they started to come up with the idea of dark matter. Well, she's got credited for looking at the stars within the galaxies and the way they were moving and all. And they figured out that, you know, this is unusual, the spinning of this galaxy. You know, they thought that the stars on the outer side had a part of a galaxy. On a spiral galaxy should be spinning at a certain speed, and ones on the inside should be spinning at a certain speed, and they weren't. And based on that, they figured something has to be pulling these things along, and they came up with, well, it's got to be dark matter. We can't see it. It's got to be dark. Anyway, Vera Rubin, if you ever put her into Wikipedia, it's interesting. Vera Rubin, Rubin. Any comments?
What are they going to do with the Hubble and the James Webb telescope? What are they going to do with them?
Oh, they all complement each other, you know. They'll keep them running as long as they possibly can. You know, Dick, we used to listen to Dick for years on this net, K2RIW, and he always said that, you know, we knew the James Webb Space Telescope was being built back then, and he said, wouldn't it be great you have still have the Hubble up there and James Webb at the same time, and you know you could point both telescopes at you know one particular spot, and you know you could be able to not only see the difference, but you'll be able to interpret different information, because Hubble was pretty much visual scope, where James Webb Space Telescope works with the infrared, you know, and of course, you know, the CCD, the charge couple device and all, and when it's all sent back to Earth, you know, they convert it, and we see pictures out of it, and we really can't see the, if we were looking, you know, at a space station there, looking out, and you know, trying to look for near-infrared galaxies off the distance, you know, you wouldn't be able to see it. But, so, you know, they all complement each other. Like I said, the other one, Chandra X-ray telescope, that was done with the X-rays. You know, they've had gamma rays telescopes, all kinds of things up there, including on Earth. And you need all of them. And as time goes by, they're getting bigger and bigger. And that's the story on that, Charlie. Back to you.
Do you think you're ever going to replace the Vera Rubin in the future?
Not in our lifetime, but, you know... you know, every time one is made, somebody's thinking about a bigger one, right? And there's a, I should look it up, probably 10 or 12 gigantic scopes in Chile alone. Who knows how many in Hawaii, all over the world, you know, we have different telescopes. And they're all... They've all gotten credit for discoveries and all. So sometimes they link them together. You have interferometry. Well, you have it with telescopes as well. You know, it's like creating one large telescope. So they'll use a couple of different ones at the same time. Try to look at black holes or whatever they're looking at. Anyway, that's the story on telescopes. Escapade, I think I might have talked about Escapade earlier, but that's going to be launched by the James New Glenn rocket, and that should be at the end of the summer, maybe September. And Escapade is two satellites, and that will be launched. Go to orbit around Mars, and that should be maybe by the time it gets there, it'll be 2027. It's going to take a long way around, but we'll eventually get there. But they're expecting that to be launched probably in September, and that would be the second launch of the James Webb. I keep saying James Webb for some reason. Of the John Glenn. John Glenn, they call it the New Glenn. The New Glenn rocket by Blue Origin. Anyway, I don't have any other tall tales, so if anybody has any comments, questions, stand by. WS2F.
Well, no comments for tonight.
Very good, Charlie, and great questions. And we'll catch a week, if not sooner. I did go to the ham fair today. I wonder if anybody went to that. But I didn't get a chance to go. I had other things to do. And it's not around the block for me anyway. I'm out in the middle of Suffolk. Anyway, have a good night for anybody that's listening. And we'll turn it over to Roy. We'll try to be on tomorrow night for the ClubNet and the Swap and Shop, and that's followed by Radio Newsline every Monday at 8:30 on these repeaters. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do here on the Technical Net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciated everyone's participation tonight. Thanks. Please, if you can, come back next Sunday at 8 when we do it all over again. Let me throw out the usual quotes. Dick, K2RW, Paul mentioned him earlier. He lives with us through these technical nets. He ran them for those many, many years. And he would always end them with good advice. So be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And I always like to throw in good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open to new ideas. But don't leave them so open that your brains fall out and get dirty on the ground. Anyway, have a great week. Next Sunday is going to be Father's Day, so I wish you all a happy Father's Day. Everyone, stay safe, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraini.
That time complete.
Good night, guys.